This is East End Ink. Nelson Algren was one of America's most famous authors. His third novel, The Man with the Golden Arm, won the first National Book Award. Despite Algren's talent, he abandoned fiction and fell into obscurity. The cause of his decline was never clear. In Never a Lovely So Real, The Life and Work of Nelson Algren, biographer Colin Asher presents the complexity of Algren's life and captures the forces working both in Algren and in mid-20th century America. He spoke at Canyon's Books in Sag Harbor in May 2019.
I was asked to say a little bit about how I got involved in this project. The short version is that during the Great Recession, I was feeling a need for sort of socially engaged literature and found myself complaining to all of my friends, to their increasing distress, about the fact that I didn't really think that American literature was dealing with what was happening during the recession, and that was a great loss, that there was something more to be said than journalism could really handle. And during that period, somebody suggested to me that I check out Nelson Algren's work. And fortuitously, the first thing I picked up was a short collection put out by Seven Stories Press called Entrapment. And it's a collection of his short works, a mix of nonfiction and fiction, and it grabbed me immediately, not only because the prose was beautiful, but also because there's a lot of material in there where he's dealing with the purpose of his writing. He was a person who wrestled with that throughout his entire career. I learned eventually. You know, he started off a member of the communist movement in the 1930s, thinking that literature was going to bring about a communist revolution. Tweaks those ideas a little bit after the Stalinist purges, and begins to think of it, sort of an adjunct to journalism, a way to expose injustices, and continues to tweak his ideas throughout his career, which I think is one of the things that kept him relevant for so long. It's true he definitely faded in the 50s and 60s, but he published his first book in 1935, and his last came out in 1984 after his death. It came out in America in 1984 after his death. And I think a big part of him continuing to work is that he always found purpose in the work, even if he wasn't being read all that widely. I won't bore you too much with all that background, but that's how I came to this work, and probably for that reason, a lot of what's in here is me talking about the purpose behind his work and talking about him wrestling with that and how he thinks it fits into the cultural and the political landscape at the time he's working. So I picked a section very much in line with that. I'm going to begin reading right at the end of the war. He was drafted into the U.S. Army in 1943, spent a long time in training stateside, eventually ended up in Europe, didn't see much action. But as the war is ending, and he's thinking about going home, he's thinking again about what the purpose of his work will be and what he's going to do when he gets home. The only thing you really need to know to contextualize the section is that he had decided to write a collection of five novels set in Chicago, each very much out of the naturalistic tradition. One would be set in Black South Chicago, one would be set in predominantly Latino neighborhood, one would be set in a white neighborhood, and he thought he was going to take on the city like that. And in this section I'm going to read, he decides this is too small of an idea, this is too provincial, and he's going to do something bigger. So as I said, the war has ended, he's in France trying to get home. Marseille was a ruin when Nelson arrived. The Germans had occupied the city for nearly 2 years, and they had been brutal stewards. In the old port district, walls jutted from piles of rubble like tombstones set at the heads of burial mounds, and cobblestones that had been ripped from the streets had collected into huge piles. Dozens of boats rested on their keels in the shallow water of the port, where the Germans sank them in a vain attempt to hold off the Allies, and the walls of the cathedral overlooking the city, Notre Dame de la Garde, were pocked with bullet holes. The muddy hillside beneath the church had become a campground for GIs after the fighting ceased, and when Nelson reached Marseille, he joined them. His superiors ordered him to stay there until they could get him back to Chicago, but they couldn't say when that would happen or how. "I just had a cot in my belongings," Nelson said later, "and in the morning, the sergeant would come and tell me what outfit I belonged to. He'd say, 'Now you're tank corps.' The next day he'd say, 'Now you're field artillery.' They tried everything to get us on that boat." The town was full of guys with arms, Nelson said. There were British troops, Americans, Canadians, and Senegalese. Because there were few military police to keep them in check, the black market thrived. brothels operated 24 hours a day, poker games went all night, and soldiers were able to trade American cigarettes or oranges for sex or wine. The city was a wild and free place, and Nelson loved it. Every morning I crept out of my... laughter from someone who knew him. Every morning I crept out of my little shelter half, jumped on a truck without a pass, and spent the whole day living off the black market, he explained. I was responsible to nobody or anything. Nelson lived that way for 3 months, and later, when he thought back on the weeks he spent trading Eisenhower coats for Chianti and studying the wrecked ships rocking in the port, he recognized them as the most isolated but least despairing of his life. I was the anonymous man, he said. I was finally myself. When I crept back into my camp each night, with nothing to show for the long day's toil but half a bottle of cheap red wine, that, for me, was the happy time. But eventually, Nelson began to long for home. It seemed like it was time, he said. I'd been drifting for years, first riding the rails and then jumping around, then, after that, jumping around with the army from place to place. I was ready, he said, to stop moving and do one thing the rest of my life and live in one place and write and simply not be preoccupied either with politics or with anything that wasn't pertinent to myself. The Army delivered Nelson to Camp Grant in Illinois on a gloomy Tuesday in November and moved him into a wooden barracks building. It was just above freezing, and snow was falling lightly. The base was just a couple hundred wooden buildings set on a barren plain north and west of Chicago, and for 4 days, Nelson did nothing but mark time, something he'd grown accustomed to in the service. Then, on his fifth day back in Illinois, he reported to the base's separation center and accepted $160.60 in an honorable discharge form that said, Private Nelson Algren spent 2 years, 4 months, and 17 days in the Army. You earned 2 overseas service bars, an American campaign medal, a European African Middle Eastern theater ribbon, and 1 bronze battle star and a good conduct medal. He was a literary writer when he entered the service and a litter bearer when he left. When Nelson reached Chicago later that day, he went looking for a flower shop, and when he found one, he bought his mother a dozen roses. Then he located a payphone and dialed Ravenswood 2405. He let it ring for a while, but Goldie, his mother, didn't answer. Nelson wanted to hear a friendly voice, but there weren't many people left in Chicago for him to call. Amanda, his ex-wife, was living in California, and most of his friends were gone. Some had chased opportunity east toward the publishing industry while he was away. Others had drifted west toward Hollywood. Some died in the war, and a few let their radical pretensions die, bought tiny homes in Gary, Indiana, and spent their time trying to earn enough money to make up for the years they dedicated to the revolution. Nelson tried a few more numbers, but they all rang in vain, so he searched the directory until he found a listing for Margaret Butler, Dorothy Farrell's widowed mother. He dialed, and Dorothy's voice came through the line. She and Nelson hadn't seen each other in years, not since 1939, possibly, but she was happy he called. Come over, she said. Nelson found Dorothy's building on a maple-lined street near the University of Chicago, and when he rang her bell, she invited him inside and told him to make himself at home. Her sister Virginia was visiting as well, and the family apartment was large and comfortable. There was food and liquor on hand, and Nelson spent the day talking about the war, catching up on events in Chicago and cracking jokes. He was one of the wittiest men I've ever known, Dorothy said. Dorothy and Virginia asked Nelson to stay for dinner, and he accepted. He finally reached Goldie after he finished eating, said his goodbyes, and prepared to leave. Do you want to take these flowers to your mother? Dorothy asked. No, the flowers are for you, Nelson lied. Then he made his way to the single basement room at 2717 Lawrence Avenue, where Goldie was living, greeted her, and settled in among the debris of their family's past. A framed newspaper dating back to the Civil War, a cuckoo clock, cotton doilies hanging from a hook on the wall, and all the dishes that had once filled the cupboards of their house on North Troy Street. Spontaneous celebrations erupted all over Chicago when the Japanese Empire surrendered to the Allies in August of 1945. 2 elderly women began marching through the streets, banging drums, and thousands of people fell in line behind them. 6 young girls dressed as drum majorettes led a separate march through downtown, and a soldier, standing on a rooftop at the corner of State and Randolph, waved an American flag in each hand while crowds passed below him. Bonfires appeared at intersections, and a motorman drove an L train around the loop, blowing his whistle the entire way. Wild abandon ruled for a night, but days of somber reflection followed. This is a day in which we should all express our eternal debt to those who laid down their lives or suffered wounds or torture that we might continue to be free, an Illinois senator said. VJ Day means more than the end of hostilities, the governor proclaimed. That means we're about to embark on a new era of peace and restoration. Sears Roebuck ran an advertisement claiming that hope, thought, understanding, and love would safeguard America's future, and scores of people attended group prayers to reflect on the war and ask searching questions about the future of humankind. It was an idealistic and heartening moment, but it passed quickly. Over the next few months, survival was reframed as victory, and the reflective tone that defined the first days after the war was replaced with triumphalism and paranoia. The Tribune published a picture of blanket-draped corpses above a caption that read, "German military detainees await hospitalization after mass suicide attempt," and its headlines became boastful. "Nazi general dies before U.S. firing squad," they crowed, "Jap prince to face trial," and, ominously, "red meddling in U.S. affairs under scrutiny." Ominous indeed. Love and understanding seemed like quaint ideas by the time Nelson reached Chicago, because by then mass consumption and status-seeking had supplanted them as guiding principles. "This peace on earth Christmas, give him the diamond ring he wants so much," advertisements counseled, "and get your post-war kitchen now." Plots of land on the outskirts of town were for sale, and so were prefabricated houses and strobosonic radios and phonographs. The Fidelity Loan Bank on Clark Street was selling the pawned jewelry it had bought during the war at liquidation prices. The spoils of war were as available to Nelson as to any other veteran with an honorable discharge, but he did not indulge. That winter, he bought a radio and a second-hand bicycle, but no diamonds, suits, or cars. He could have used his GI benefits to purchase a home on the edge of the city with no money down, but instead, he returned to his old neighborhood and looked for an apartment where he could work without distraction. In January, he found a cold water flat that suited him on the second floor of 1523 West Waubonsie Avenue. Trash cans piled with refuse lined the sidewalk out front, and stray newspaper pages gathered in the gutters. There was no refrigerator. Heat was provided by an oil stove, and the shower was down the hall, but the rent was only $10 a month, and the bedroom was large enough to double as an office. There were large windows in each room, and when he gazed through them, he saw a streetlight, a peach tree growing through the sidewalk, a saloon called the Lucky Star that displayed a neon Schlitz sign in its window, and a yeast factory. Nelson moved into the apartment when it became available. Then he began to reacquaint himself with the city. He watched the bar's windows and the strangers passing them on the sidewalk. He could see well enough through the glass brick set in the bar's front walls to know when people were playing cards inside, and sometimes he joined them. He visited the YMCA to exercise and shower every day, dropped by his old haunts in the Triangle, and began attending police lineups again so he could transcribe the chief detective's interrogations. "You're a jack roller," he wrote. "No, I'm Mexican. Haven't worked the past year. Just got out of the Bridewell Wednesday." People were talking about recovery that winter. They said Chicago was destined to play a prominent role in the American century, but the city didn't feel much changed to Nelson. The L still wobbled on uneven rails and sent sparks into the night. There was a housing shortage, and people were having a hard time finding jobs. Massive labor strikes were making headlines, and poverty remained endemic. The city's newest black residents were crowding into tenements on the south side because redlining and housing covenants prevented them from moving to more affluent neighborhoods. And the suburban migration that mortgage brokers referred to as the American dream was, Nelson knew, nothing more than white flight. The only change Nelson could discern was the story Chicago had begun telling about itself. The city was defined by its industry when he was a child. It transformed into a gangster's town later, and then a battlefield for the class war. Now it was trying to remake itself as the backdrop to a domestic drama, featuring men wearing gray flannel suits and chaste women in neatly pressed house dresses. They took their social cues from Look, Leader, Pageant, and Bazaar, and they believed that virtue and consumption were synonymous. There were Fords in their garages and the Family Circle magazine on their coffee tables. That image seemed dangerously dishonest to Nelson, and the emphasis of his work shifted in response to it. He'd been planning to write a series of novels set in neighborhoods defined by their dominant ethnic group. But after he returned home from the war, he began thinking in grander terms. Chicago, he realized, was a perfect synecdoche for the country, a place so in love with the idea of its virtue that it was willing to disavow, in the name of the common good, anyone who failed to meet its narrow and exacting standards. it had great symbolic value for that reason, and Nelson decided that using his work to undermine that image would be more impactful than continuing to develop the naturalistic novels he outlined years earlier. This project defined the next decade of Nelson's career. He used his fictional writing to create a counter-narrative by humanizing the people who had, quote, failed before the radio commercials and fallen short of the standards of every self-respecting magazine. And he addressed the country's shortcomings directly in his nonfiction writing. Despite what you've been told, he wrote, millions of Americans still live out their hand-to-mouth hours without friendship or love. They belong to no particular street and no particular city. They pass from furnished room to furnished room and belong not even to their own time, not even to themselves. Every day is D-Day under the L, he proclaimed. And the lucky few who manage to climb the social ladder derive little satisfaction from their reward. Never has any people possessed such a superfluity of physical luxuries, companioned by such a dearth of emotional necessities, he wrote. In no other country is such great wealth acquired so purposefully, put to such small purpose. Never has any people driven itself so resolutely towards such diverse goals to derive so little satisfaction from attainment of any.
This is East End, Inc. We're listening to author Colin Usher talking about Never a Lovely So Real, the life and work of Nelson Algren.
1949, Man with the Golden Arm comes out. 1950, Algren wins the first National Book Award and becomes a huge star. Immediately afterward, everybody starts distancing themselves from him, and his career almost immediately starts falling apart. So he, I swear I won't go on too long. He sells the film rights to The Man with the Golden Arm before it even wins the National Book Award. So this is spring of 1950. Within 6 months, every person involved with that deal, the director, the film star, the agent, and Algren's co-writer for the screenplay had all been blacklisted. And so that's the environment that he's coming into as he becomes famous. After The Man with the Golden Arm, his next book is Chicago City on the Make, which is a book-length prose poem, which I think is a work of genius. He wrote it as a piece of magazine writing for Chicago Magazine, and it is a deeply political work. It talks about how you can't build a fortress out of a nation and then still expect to create art. He name-checks McCarthy, and so he's involving himself directly in the Red Scare. That magazine piece was censored and all the political content was taken out. And then his publisher later published it as a book with an incredibly small print run and no publicity at all. After that, he goes on a speaking tour where he's giving a speech about the Red Scare and encouraging students to resist conforming to the post-war consensus and to fight McCarthy, basically. And he places portions of the speech in some newspapers. His publisher says they want to do a book based on the speech, basically an anti-Red Scare book. And so he spends months turning the speech into something that would stand up in book form. And it's a deeply political work. In its published form, it's called Nonconformity Writing on Writing. And it's about the politics of art and authorship. It's due in 1953. The deadline for the publisher is 1953. While he's writing it, he is denied a passport by the State Department, because he had been associated with the Communist Party earlier in his life. His publisher finds out about that. I mean, he tells them. It wasn't a secret. At the same time, he is the president or the vice chair of the Committee to Save the Rosenbergs, Julius Neffel Rosenberg. And unbeknownst to him, people that he used to be associated with in the 30s approached the FBI to say that he had been a communist and that they had proof. And the FBI begins contacting lots of his professional contacts. So amidst all that, he hands this book in, and then the publisher sits on it for 6 months and says, no. They never really say why. They say, we don't think it'll be good for your career. I said I found his work in 2009 during the recession, and I was looking for work that spoke to our political moment, and somebody suggested him, which seems odd, because he was not of the political moment, but I actually thought that was deeply insightful. And yes, when I read him, I was engaged by his ideas, but I also read his work and thought it was incredibly prescient. You know, he was writing The Man with the Golden Arm is remembered mostly because Sinatra made a film out of it. But you know, he's writing about the morphine epidemic after the war. And he's writing about, you know, how opiate addiction is the American disease, he calls it. And he sees it as a way for people to escape a society that they feel to be incredibly oppressive in its demands that they conform. I mean, I think that is incredibly prescient. You know, he's talking about the criminal justice system after the war as well, and writes passages about how, you know, essentially we used to lock up people who were dangerous, now we lock up people who we don't know what else to do with. You know, and he was such a close observer of American society. He's catching on to that in 1947, 1948, and we're still wrestling with that now, the implications. So I think he's very much of the moment in an odd way, and I think that part of that is to our great shame because we haven't really dealt with all the things that he identified as being problems. The book is sort of written in the moment, and I wrestled a lot with, you know, do I give this man credit for having ideas that were ahead of his time, or do I just present his ideas and allow readers to judge? So I don't do a lot of talking about how incredibly, you know, advanced he was for his age. That sounds rather condescending. But he was, you know, he's a person who in the 1930s joins the Communist Party in part because he finds American racism to be disgusting. And, you know, he definitely had some views that we would consider retrograde these days. There's no question he was not much of a feminist. But in a lot of other ways, he was trying to force America to reckon with things that, as you say, we still haven't reckoned with. So at this period in his life, he left Chicago in 74, spent a long time in New Jersey writing a book about Reuben Hurricane Carter, which he was dedicated to proving Carter's innocence. Carter was then convicted a second time of murder, and so he can't sell his book. So he's very frustrated, but he's also having this sort of moment at the end of his life. Some of his books are going back into print in Germany, and you're going to hear in this chapter he also is... he's given an award that sort of heartens him. In his prime, Nelson was a solitary creature, a man most at ease in his goat's nest, a flat that looked down onto an empty lot in a trash-strewn alley. He forswore luxury, scoffed at chasing status, trained like a boxer to keep his mind sharp, and avoided the company of writers. Because writers who spend time with writers write books about writers who spend time with writers, so that their work will be read by other writers. He was never interested in that, so instead he wandered the neon wilderness by night and stalked people who lived behind billboards or slept in cage hotels. They were the story no one saw, and he believed it was possible to forecast the future by reading their scars. But by the time he reached Sag Harbor, Nelson was a jolly old man with a big round belly, and he had had enough of abstention. He liked to laugh and to make people laugh, and when he found himself in uptight company, he let them know he had no patience for pretension. Solitude had also lost its appeal, so Nelson surrounded himself with friends and admirers. Sag Harbor, Nelson soon learned, was thick with writers, and when his new neighbors, Kurt Vonnegut, Peter Mathiasen, John Irving, and E.L. Doctorow sought him out, he welcomed their company. Betty Friedan had a house just across the street from Nelson's, and she often drove him around town because his only means of transportation was a used bicycle. Nelson was no longer writing regularly by the time he reached Sag Harbor, but his mind was still sharp. Because there was nothing else to preoccupy him, he dwelled on the past and wondered how he would be remembered when he was gone. There was a debate about the merits of his life and work raging constantly in his mind, and no side ever claimed victory for long. Then, in February 1981, Nelson changed his mind again. That month, he learned that the American Academy and National Institute of Arts and Letters had decided to make him a full member. Nelson had been wary of awards for years and was dubious about the intentions and integrity of the people who conferred them. When an arts organization presented him with a grant a few years earlier, he'd refused to thank them because he didn't see why he should, and he had had Kurt Vonnegut accept the Award of Merit for the novel in his stead. But this was different. Membership in the Academy wasn't a bauble conferred by the literary establishment. It was an invitation to join. Nelson's formal induction into the Academy was scheduled for May 20th, and he decided to throw himself a party to celebrate it on May 9th. He invited all his friends to attend, and most said they would try. The afternoon before the party, a journalist named J.W. Weatherby dropped by Nelson's house for an interview and found him in good spirits. They sat in the living room, and Nelson joked about his nomination and reflected on his career, I didn't know I was running for office until they informed me I was elected, he said. Puts you in the league of people who are distinguished, so I'm told by my literary friends. If I'd only written one book, he said, I'd want it to be A Walk on the Wild Side, or maybe this new one, The Devil's Stocking. When Weatherby left, Nelson was alone, and everything he needed to do to prepare for the party had been done, so he went out. He got on his bike and pedaled around Sag Harbor, beneath the dark spring sky, till he tired of it, and then he returned home. He entered his cottage after midnight. Sometime later, he went to the bathroom on the second floor. His chest was feeling tight again. While he stood there alone, his heart quivered and then stopped. He fell, and as he did, his left wrist smacked against something. The glass face of his wristwatch broke, and the hands froze in place. They read, 6:05. Nelson was buried in Sag Harbor's Oakland Cemetery on Monday, May 11, before a crowd of about 30 people. Stephen Deutsch and his daughter Catherine were there, and so were Peter Mathiasen, Pete Hamill, Gloria Jones, and Linda Ronstadt. A woman with bright red hair and blue-green eyes arrived wearing all black and began sobbing. She told the other mourners that she had read every word Nelson wrote and intended to forswear novels for the remainder of her life now that he was dead. When the ceremony began, Joe Pantaro stepped forward and read from one of Nelson's poems. A cold wind was blowing, and he said, "Again that hour when taxis start deadheading home, before the trolley buses start to run, and snow dreams and the list of mist drift down, when from asylum, barrack, cell, and cheap hotel, all those whose lives were lived by someone else come again with palms outstretched to claim what never rightly was their own." Nelson's casket was lowered into the grave when Pantaro finished, and later, a headstone bearing an epitaph, selected by his agent, Candido Donadio, was installed at its head. It read, "The end is nothing, the road is all." Thank you.
This is East End Inc. We heard Colin Asher talking about Never a Lovely So Real, The Life and Work of Nelson Algren, published in 2019 by W.W. Norton. Colin Asher spoke at Canyon's Books in Sag Harbor in May 2019. Some upcoming free literary events sponsored by Canyon's Cultural Cafe on 290 Main Street, Sag Harbor, all at 6 p.m., include on Thursday, June 27th, a dramatic reading of fiction by novelist Shelley Raybeck, author of Sparrow Beach, with actor Gerard Doyle. On Thursday, July the 11th, sailors John Aldridge and Anthony Sosinski present Speck in the Sea, a story of survival and rescue. And on Thursday, July the 18th, poet Grace Shulman presents Morning Songs, poems of sorrow and beauty, with readings by various poets. And on Thursday, August the 15th, The Nation, editor-publisher Katrina van den Heuvel and Russia expert Stephen Cohen in conversation about war with Russia, dangers of the new Cold War, and consequences for U.S. politics. More events are listed at canyonsbooks.com. East End Inc. programs are archived at eastendinc.blogspot.com. Today's program was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Marianne Calendrill and Catherine Zilker. I'm Hazel Kahn.